Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show, the show that takes the mystery out of spirituality with your host, David Gagan, engineer, science director, scholarly researcher of life's mysteries, and author of The Endless Journey.
Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show. I'm host Dave Gagan, and this is the show where we talk about subjects which are critical to our happiness and spiritual evolution. Please note that all the chat room questions will be answered in the chat room on next week's show, as well as posted on my website, which is davidgagan.com, hopefully within a day or so of the show. When you visit the site, you can ask additional questions, even about other shows. You can listen to any previous show on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com by searching for either David Gagan or Common Sense Spirituality. I've launched a new podcast titled Aspects of Spirituality, which is also on iHeartRadio. There I explain my worldview and what I have learned about the mysteries of life in short weekly podcasts. I hope you'll join me there. Today we are going to discuss a piece of mankind's prehistory, which refers to a period of time before written records. This is in the neighborhood of over, say, 3,000 years ago. Understanding our past helps us understand how we came to accept many of our misconceptions about spirituality and religion. It also helps fill in the picture of who we are and where we came from. Many of the stories we learned in school and church in regards to mankind's history make little sense when compared to archaeological evidence. Yet we use these misunderstandings as a basis for how we live and how we treat our fellow man. Our guest today is Andrew Collins, who has been investigating the idea of advanced civilizations in prehistory, along with paranormal phenomena, since 1979. He is the co-discoverer of a massive complex beneath the Giza Plateau, which is now known as Collins's Caves. He is the author of several books, to include From the Ashes of Angels, a book I read some 15 years ago, and Atlantis in the Caribbean, which I read a few weeks ago. Andrew Collins. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
David, hi. Good day to you.
You've been doing this for a long time. I didn't add up the years. What got you interested in ancient civilizations?
I think it's always been there since I was a child. I pondered on the mysteries of the universe, whether they were, ancient or more modern. My early youth was spent gorging books on UFOs, and that led to books on ancient mysteries like von Daniken's Chariots of the Gods. I started to realise there was a connection between the mind, paranormal phenomena, UFOs, and the landscape itself, in particular ancient monuments, which in Britain obviously would include places like Stonehenge and Avebury and the other stone and earthen monuments all around the place. So I started to take an interest in those. And very gradually that interest spread out to other parts of the world. Obviously the Great Pyramids, the Nazca Lines, the Sumerian civilization. But it would take me years before I'd end up writing about the subject, because my early career as a writer was mostly supernatural mysteries, which were true, what we call psychic questing, going off around the landscape, finding artifacts and communicating with guardians and things like that. But my first proper book, really, on this subject was From the Ashes of Angels, which was first published in 1996. And this was the culmination of several years of work into the idea of the Watchers and the Nephilim and the Anunnaki being flesh and blood human beings that existed on Earth and may well have seeded human civilization sometime around the end of the last ice age. And obviously you mentioned that book, you said you read it about 15 years ago. I mean, it was well received all the way around the world and was actually a Times bestseller in this country. And I never looked back from there.
Okay. Now, I was not aware that you had found Collins's caves. Tell me about, what did you find underneath the Giza Plateau? I know Edgar Cayce, you know, he talked about, you know, rooms underneath the Sphinx and such. What's Collins's caves?
Well, back in the late 70s, I started to work with psychics. You know, people like Edgar Cayce, but over in this country. And they would, you know, tell me about all different mysteries of the past and things like that, and I would listen to them. And one of them in particular, by the name of Bernard, who features in various of my psychic questing books, one day said that he'd had the strange dream about these underground passages and caves on the Giza Plateau. And he felt that they were much older than the pyramid age, and that they still existed today, and that, you know, there may well be an entrance into them. And I never forgot this. And at that time, it was like a case of, oh, well, you know, that's a nice idea, but I don't think ever I would be in a position to investigate them. But come the early 2000s, I was actually visiting Egypt on a number of occasions, having written about it quite extensively by that time, including a book on Tutankhamun, a book on the origins of the pyramids, and various other things. And I started to learn about stories about these caves once again. And I then embarked on a serious research project working with an Egyptological writer by the name of Nigel Skinner Simpson, and he found some extremely obscure references to this cave system, which were over 200 years old from diary notes of a British consul general over there who had employed some men to try and investigate different parts of the plateau. And we set out to try and find them. And I knew roughly whereabouts the entrance was, which was in the northwest corner of the plateau, which is at least a mile or so away from where anybody normally goes. And to be honest, it's not somewhere that, you know, I won't say you're not allowed, but it's very difficult to get to. And we went into this particular tomb, which at that particular time, there was absolutely nothing written about it at all, other than one reference from the 1840s. And it wasn't catalogued or anything. And we went inside there, myself and my then wife, and we searched around in the darkness looking for any possible you know, entrances to anywhere, and couldn't find anything. Came away from there thinking, you know, maybe we were wrong. But then my colleague Nigel found another reference, which seemed to suggest that we were at the right place. So we went back in 2008, I think it was in March, this time with the blessing of the Edgar Cayce Foundation, who were sort of happy to come on board with this. And we actually found a tiny crack in a wall that led into a huge natural cave system that nobody had written about for at least 200 years. And this extended back as far as you could possibly go, and almost certainly beyond where we actually ended up. And this was a very dangerous, very claustrophobic place. In places, it was massive. And, you know, there was no evidence here of hieroglyphs and things like that. I mean, there was a certain amount of marks on the walls which could have predated that period.
Did it appear to be a natural cave?
It was a natural cave.
It was natural,
I mean,
okay.
Yeah, it had been created probably through the erosion of water, maybe tens if not hundreds of thousands of years ago. In fact, it may have even been present when the seas actually rose up to the edge of the Giza Plateau. And therefore it was almost on the shores of the water at that time. And, I mean, various archaeologists I know went into it afterwards, and they said that there's a very strong likelihood that there's evidence of early, you know, humans here that probably go back tens, if not hundreds of thousands of years. The only trouble is obviously the discovery of it created a massive political wrangle, of almost an international incident, which is actually with repercussions even through this day. And the entrance was eventually not only closed up by the Egyptian authorities, but also bricked up as well. So it looks very much like that we'll be unlikely to explore there in the near future. But I know various Egyptologists who are pushing to try and get new investigations of the caves. So watch this space.
Yeah, fascinating. If there wasn't so many other great things to talk to you about, I'd want to dig into it further.
For those people that are interested in it, though, I wrote a book about the subject called Beneath the Pyramids, which is still available, and that accounts the entire discovery of the cave system.
Okay, great. You know, while we're on Giza, you know, building a pyramid's a lot of effort to bury someone. Any idea what these pyramids were used for?
Well, the orthodox conventional view is that they are tombs, and I think that that's probably quite close to the mark. But I think that the term tomb does it an injustice. We think of tombs as in a coffin or something like that that you would have to bury somebody, and I don't think it was the case. I think that if anything, these are ascension machines, if you like. You know, they're a way of projecting the soul or spirit of the pharaoh into the afterlife, into the sky world, and it would seem as if they are laid out and designed with that specific purpose in mind. Their whole shape, their positioning on the plateau, the underlying geometry in the area of the actual pyramids all conforms to a grand cosmic scheme. And it's one that I wrote about in Beneath the Pyramids and returned to in a new book coming out called The Cygnus Key, which I'll be talking to you, I'm sure, about within the next few months. But at the moment, obviously, the main interest, of course, is Atlantis.
Right.
And this is something which is at the back of everything, because back in the 19th century, a US congressman by the name of Ignatius Donnelly wrote the seminal work on the subject, which was called Atlantis, the Antediluvian World. I think this came out in 1882. And basically what he postulated was that the various civilizations around the world, like the Babylonian, the Egyptian, the people of the Indus Valley, and as well as the people in the New World, in the Americas, the Maya, the Aztecs, the Incas, etc., were all the product of a mother civilization, one that had existed on Atlantis, and that he placed this in the middle of the Atlantic, in the area of the Azores, and believed that it was a huge continent that had existed and that had sunk. But we now know that that's not the case, that there are lots of differences between the different cultures in the world, in the old world and the new world. Plus, there never was a continent in the middle of the Atlantic. So where was Atlantis? And this was the premise that I went into writing this book, which has come out, called Atlantis in the Caribbean. And all of the evidence that seems to be presented by Plato, who is our main source for the story of Atlantis, is that he's talking about somewhere beyond what were known as the Pillars of Hercules, which were like big rocks that marked the exit of the Mediterranean, somewhere out in what's today the Atlantic Ocean, although at that time it was just known as the Atlantic Sea. And that he said that beyond this was the opposite continent. Now that has to be the American continent, because obviously that's the only place that you would reach if you went to the west from the Pillars of Hercules. And that he said that here somewhere was this massive island continent, and a series of smaller islands were used as stepping stones by ancient mariners to reach the opposite continent. Well, those stepping stones are still there today. These are the Bahamas and the islands of the Caribbean. So I began to look to find out if there was evidence of a lost continent or something in the area of the Bahamas and the Caribbean. And indeed there is, and it's what's known as the Great Bahama Bank today. And up till around 8,000 to 9,000 BC, this was a massive continent that had existed to the north of Cuba. And it was sunk shortly after the end of the last ice age through the rising of the seas because of the melting of the ice sheets that had been present for tens of thousands of years up to this time. And the more I looked into this, the more I realized that what Plato was describing actually was almost certainly the island of Cuba, with the actual sunken lands being the Bahaman landmass. And the more I looked into this, the more I found evidence from not only Greek mythology to do with the existence of this island continent, which goes under various names. I mean, it's not just known as Atlantis, but it's also known as the Hesperides, which means the islands of the west or the islands of the setting sun, which bear all of the descriptions of the largest of the islands of the Caribbean, which is, you know, Cuba, Hispaniola, and Puerto Rico. And so I started focusing my attentions on them. I also found out that there are many Mesoamerican cultures that also see that their earliest origins of having come from an island that goes under various names like Aztlan and Talapan, which means the old red land, which existed somewhere in the vicinity of Cuba. And the more I looked into this, the more I realized that Cuba was an incredibly important place in the past, and that there's evidence of activity going back there at least to 6000 BC that's been discovered. Plus, in the Bahamas itself, there are a number of underwater archaeological structures that have been uncovered by the Edgar Cayce people from the 1960s right the way through to the 2000s. My colleagues Greg and Laura Little have done incredible work in the Bahamas discovering and investigating, much to their peril in many cases, many of these structures off of islands like Bimini, but also Andros Island, which is one of the largest islands, what is the largest island of the Bahamas. And there's strong evidence that there was some kind of antediluvian culture that existed in this region at a very early date.
How big would this area have been that sunk?
Well, hundreds of miles in length. I mean, Cuba itself is obviously many hundreds of miles across. If you can see another Cuba on top of the existing one, this would have been the approximate size of the Bahaman landmass. And it stretched all the way from, let's say, the equivalent to the west of, let's say, Fort Lauderdale, all the way down the Keys, right the way down beyond Florida itself, right the way down almost into what is today Cuban waters. And it's a fascinating area, and we've only just begun to explore the underwater structures that exist in this region.
How much work has been done on Cuba itself as far as finding? I'm not aware of a lot of, or really any, large temples or ancient ruins on Cuba. Is there a lot of them there?
Well, I mean, firstly, there are a number of accounts from the early period of colonization and conquest, of course, of Cuba itself, of conquistadors and travelers and whatever, going into the depths of Cuba, which is still unexplored to this day, and finding very strange stone statues made of black, you know, polished idols and stuff like this. The sort of stuff from fairy tales, in a way. And unfortunately, because these people weren't archaeologists, nothing was followed up, I'm afraid. Today, the Cuban archaeological community is in its infancy, really, in the sense that they haven't got hardly any money to do anything. And it is very difficult for them to explore the interior of Cuba. I mean, let alone, you know, it's very difficult. And I think that the fact that it's beginning to open up now, you know, with obviously the new relationship between the United States and Cuba, hopefully we we can start investigating not just the interior of Cuba, but obviously the actual Cuban waters themselves. I mean, some of your listeners will know that in 2001, there was an announcement that a series of underwater structures had been found off of the west coast of Cuba. And that these were at a great depth, in fact, far too deep, really, for them simply to have been structures there that had been covered over naturally by the rising sea after the end of the last ice age. But the radar evidence and you know, the ROVs and things like that that had been sent down to look at these things certainly suggested that there was something there, and that there was, you know, regular shaped blocks that were rectilinear, triangular, pyramidical, etc., which may well form part of some kind of underwater structure that was perhaps plunged down into the depths as part of some kind of cataclysm. And this is the other thing.
Is anybody investigating that now, or has that kind of died?
Well, the problem is the great depth. And the great depth required an incredible amount of money to be able to explore it properly. And we're talking about the use of submersibles, you know, sort of mini submarines and stuff like this. And at the time, I was involved with this because, you know, I just had a book out on Atlantis. And the Nat Geo had offered an exclusivity deal to the salving company that had actually discovered this, but so had Random House, the book publishers, and there was a certain amount of rivalry trying to get the company on board to have the rights to explore this. And the problem was, is that the company involved just couldn't produce good enough evidence for either of those parties to part with a large amount of money, and we're talking about, you know, millions of dollars. So it just did not go ahead. And there was a lot of politics involved, you know, because there was so much possible finances to be gained from this. You know, attorneys got involved and things like this, and it just did not pan out, I'm afraid. So the whole thing died a death in 2001. There's still a lot of information about this. I've written about it extensively in this new book, you know, Atlantis in the Caribbean, which is coming out. But, you know, it's something which I'll happily say, it's still there. And hopefully at some point in the future we can get some kind of resolution. But it's a fascinating story, which you can read about in the book.
Yeah, it is. I remember when it came out, and it kind of blew me away. And I was hoping they'd put more effort into it. But as you say, money is the driving thing, money and politics.
It is, and it has to be, because, you know, it's not cheap to go underwater in that way.
Now you know, everybody from Plato on down says Atlantis sunk. And now the question is, you know, what are the theories? You have a theory on how it might have sunk. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about the meteor, asteroid, or whatever?
All over the world, there are accounts of some kind of global cataclysm, something that devastated the world in the distant past. These accounts talk about fire from the sky. They talk about floods, they talk about periods of darkness, they talk about serpents that appear in the sky and crash to the ground, acid rains, fire rains, and things like this. And anthropologists have collected together these, and they've recorded them in books for the last 200-300 years, in fact all the way back to the 16th, 15th century, when the first conquistadors and Europeans reached the New World. They were recording these accounts from the area of Cuba, the Bahamas, and Central and South America, for instance, and obviously amongst a great many Native American tribes. And, you know, people like myself and Graham Hancock and whatever have talked about the possibility of there being some kind of catastrophe based on something like a comet impact or an asteroid in various of our books. But we now have scientific evidence that this did actually take place. A date of approximately 10,800 BC, and that it would seem as if a comet fragmented, possibly after it had passed around the Sun on its so-called perihelion, and that it then sent towards the Earth hundreds and thousands of small pieces that entered into the atmosphere, began burning up, and probably even exploded before even impact, on the Earth itself, causing these incredible explosions, which would have been like mini, nuclear strikes all over the world, but in particular in the area of North America. That seems to have been the place that was greatest struck at this time. Having said that, these impact events occurred all the way through Europe, through Western Asia, and that even around the whole of the world is this ash layer, which I've seen myself in Belgium and Holland, which is about 5 inches thick of thick black ash that dates around 10,800 BC and is the product of wildfires, massive amounts of wildfires creating this soot and other, very chemically damaging debris that goes up into the atmosphere, remains there, and then probably comes down as acid rain. And having done so, obviously it blocks out the Sun and the Moon and of course the stars for a long period of time. And the result of this is that it changes the temperature, it lowers the temperature, and you get this mini ice age, which is exactly what happened in 10,800 BC for a period of 1,200 years. And this is known as the Younger Dryas event. It affected the North American continent, affected Europe and Asia as well. And this seems to be what is remembered by these global catastrophes stories all the way around the world.
Let me understand the ice age was slowly receding. And then all of a sudden it stopped receding and started coming back for 1,200 years. And then it went back to its receding again.
Yeah,
and that's
it
what
did.
The Dryas, and I guess in the U.S. they call it the Valders, did they?
I think that the Valders Reavance is the... Yeah, I can't remember which way around it is.
The Valders.
Valders Reavance was a term which I think was used in America or Europe. The term now that's generally used worldwide is definitely the Younger Dryas.
Younger Dryas, okay.
There was the Older Dryas. The Older Dryas basically was the Ice Age itself. And as you quite rightly pointed out, the ice sheets, which had been anything up to 2 miles thick in places, had been gradually receding since about 13,000 BC. So it was actually a nice warm climate come about 10,800 BC, and then within a generation, those ice sheets are back, and that is unnatural. And
right.
Scientists have tried to understand why this onslaught, of the ice should come back with such vengeance, and we're now pretty certain that the cause of that was a cosmic event. And this cosmic event would have created these wildfires all the way around the world. So it created this thick layer, which is known in Europe as the Ocello Horizon, but in America, in North America, it's generally known as the Black Mat, MAT. And this seems to have been the consequences of this thick nuclear winter that would have resulted from this event. And the other important thing is that large pieces of this comet probably fell on the ice sheets themselves. And what this would have done is instantly vaporized this water that would then have careered through the valleys of the mountain chains and whatever, creating instant floods and destroying everything in their paths. And this would have flowed southwards beyond even the areas of the ice themselves, and devastated every single thing in their path, and carried with them huge great blocks, hundreds and thousands of tons apiece, that are still littered over many parts of North America to this day, and I'm sure are present in other parts of the world as well. It's a big subject, of course, and it's something
Andrew, we're talking about Noah's flood as well, right? I mean, this would be part of that.
We are, yes, of course. I mean, that's an echo of the memory of this. But, of course, right. Noah's flood is something that we have from the Bible. The Bible talks about just a flood in its own right. It doesn't talk about fire. But that same story is found in other, what they call pseudepigraphal, which is like, you know, the works that didn't quite make the Bible. Other pseudepigraphal works like the Book of Enoch and the Book of Giants and the Book of Jubilees and things like this, they make mention of this same catastrophe. And in some of these accounts, they do add that there was rains of fire as well. So it does seem as if it was much bigger than simply just a, you know, an all-encompassing flood or deluge of the type which the Bible tells us. And of course, that same story that's in the Bible is found all over the world. I mean, not right. just in Babylonian texts, which may well have influenced the Bible, but as far away as Southeast Asia and island Southeast Asia, and even in North America. I mean, the same story about these lone survivors, you know, a family on a boat sending out, you know, a bird, you know, a raven or a dove or whatever that comes back with a piece of you know, twig or something. I mean, you know, there are different variations, but it's there all the way around the world. And it may even be suggested that the Bible one is not even the original.
Yeah, exactly. Ted, talk about the Carolina Bays. I thought that was interesting.
Well, the Carolina Bays are hundreds and thousands, and when I say hundreds and thousands, we're talking about at least 100,000 elliptical craters, is the best word for them, that exist from New York State all the way down to Florida. But obviously, as their name suggests, they are most concentrated in the Carolinas themselves. And these can be anything from the size of a house to a quarter of a mile in size. And they're all orientated northwest to southeast. Some of them are quite shallow, some of them are deeper, some of them have become ponds, some of them, you know, you can only see from the air. But they are very clearly apparent if you look at aerial surveys, particularly those from the 1920s and 1930s. Which is when they were first discovered by aerial surveys that took place in the Carolinas. And of course, these were brought to the attention of geologists who tried to make sense of them. And very quickly, certain smart people, some scientists, came up with the idea that they could be impact craters. And there was a lot of hoo-ha about exactly, you know, what would have caused them. I mean, people thought they might have been caused by, you know, underwater springs or rutting animals or wind or something like this. But I think that there now is pretty good evidence to suggest that they are the result of impacts. And we're not talking about fragments themselves coming down and just hitting the ground. We're talking about almost the splatter of airbursts overhead that would have, you know, taken out a layer of the topsoil to create this elliptical shape. And it also tells us very clearly that there's a directionality involved in this. And it seems as if whatever it was came out of the northwest and headed towards the southeast. But the sheer fact of the distribution of the Carolina Bays tells us that some, at least, of these fragments would also have impacted with the North Atlantic Ocean. And this obviously brings the possibility of massive tsunami waves that would have drowned not only coastal regions of the Americas and Europe and Africa, but also, of course, the Bahaman landmass and the Caribbean. They would have almost been drowned, and this conforms completely with various legends that we have from the Bahamas and the Caribbean that talk about not just one, but two separate drowning incidents. One where the waters came in and went away, and then when they came back, they more permanently drowned the region. And of course, this is exactly what would have occurred. Because to start off with, you would have had tsunamis that would have been the result of these impact events, and probably which would have also triggered things like underwater earthquakes, which we know cause tsunamis. But also, then afterwards, the melting of the ice sheets by the impact events would have suddenly risen the sea levels and taken up a lot of low-lying land, and of course, almost completely drowning the Bahaman landmass, which is exactly what Plato tells us happened to Atlantis. I mean, the word that we use is sunk, but the better word would be drowned as opposed to sunk. That's what happened to Atlantis. It drowned. It did not sink, as in a huge, you know, rocky landmass just gradually disappearing beneath the waters, which is the idea that we may get from, you know, blockbusting films. That's not what happened. We're talking about the drowning through tsunamis of the area first, then after that, the waters gradually permanently coming back and taking this low-lying areas forever.
What kind of communication have you found that records of communication that there might have been between the old world, if you will, and the new world, South America, Central America, Mesoamerica, etc., and say Europe or even the Middle East?
Well, this was one of the important things of the book for me to establish, because what I was proposing is that Plato himself came to hear of legends regarding the existence not only of this former landmass that had existed in the area of the Bahamas and the Caribbean, but also that it had been destroyed in some kind of cataclysm, and that the peoples that were there, whatever kind of culture they achieved, were destroyed in this, with only perhaps a few survivors. So how is it possible that these ideas could have come into the Mediterranean world during the age of Plato, which was around 350 BC? That's when he wrote his two main books on this subject, which was the Timaeus and then later the Critias, which are these dialogues that he created. And so what I needed to show was that there was a bridge that existed either during his time or much earlier that showed this line of communication between the Bahamas and the Caribbean and, of course, North America, etc. And so I embarked upon this research project to look for this, and it's everywhere. There is evidence of Romans, of Greeks, of Celts, of Phoenicians, of Carthaginians, and possibly even, you know, earlier Bronze Age peoples reaching all of the Americas at a date either at the time or preceding Plato. In fact, there is even one account from one writer in Roman times, from this guy called Solinus, that talks about the voyage from from Africa to the islands of the Hesperides, taking, I think it's something like 40 days. That's it, 40 days journey, sailing west. Well, this is almost identical to the amount of time that it took Christopher Columbus and the various vessels, on the journeys that he went via the Canary Islands to reach the Bahamas and the Caribbeans. So it's very clear that the Hesperides was known about, and the Hesperides were almost certainly the three main islands of the Caribbean: Cuba, Hispaniola, and Puerto Rico.
Okay. The what you know, Sitchin had a lot of interesting thoughts, and of course, he thought that there was a close tie between the Sumerian and the various cultures there, and the Mesoamerica and such. And one of the things that I noticed when I was reading Sitchin a number of years ago is he had identified this bronze clamps which form a T shape, and they're used to hold the megalithic stones together, and he found I believe it was three total examples of these clamps that were interchangeable, and one of them he found in Pumapuca in Bolivia, and another one in Peru, Cusco, and the other one was in Lagash in Sumer, which is the Middle East. It seems amazing that something so identical was used in two entirely different places in the world. Any thoughts on that?
Yes. I mean, firstly, these ideas are not new. I mean, they go back to Donnelly, Ignatius Donnelly, and people like H.S. Bellamy, who wrote extensively about Tiwanaku in Bolivia, and believed that that had been subject to a cataclysm around 10,000 BC. And a lot of these ideas had been around, you know, before Sitchin picked them up. And I've seen them myself in various countries of the world. I've seen them in Cambodia, I've seen them in Bolivia at Tiwanaku, and at various, I've seen them in Peru, places like Cuzco. I've seen them in ancient Egypt, and as you rightly pointed out, they're in other places of the world. And basically what they are metal clamps that hold together two different stones. And yeah, the idea of doing this could have been something that developed in isolation. But on the other hand, there is always that possibility that there was some kind of, not so much mother civilization as Donnelly suggested, but communications on a global level at a very early date. And this is something which I write about not only in my other books, but particularly in this new book, The Cygnus Key, which is coming out at the end of the year, which basically I show that behind all of this is a lost civilization, and that lost civilization almost certainly began in southern Siberia as early as the beginning of modern humanity, about 40,000 to 45,000 years ago. And a lot of the ideas that we took into civilization came from a much earlier type of so-called archaic human known as the Denisovans, who were the cousins of the Neanderthals of Europe, and their last area of existence was southern Siberia, where so many firsts for humanity and technology began. So there is this global civilization, really, one that had its roots in a single place, a single trunk of a tree that branches out into every part of the world eventually, and probably continues that communication and that contact right the way through to the flowering of the civilizations that we know of, everything from Egypt to Babylon to, you know, the places Cambodia, Java, Peru, Bolivia, etc., etc. I mean, you know, just in the papers in the news this week is 450 new ancient sites discovered in the area that's being cleared, very sadly, in Brazil, the rainforest, in the region known as Ica, which borders Peru. And some of these structures go back to 8,000 BC. Now, that's almost to the time when Plato tells us that the final throngs of Atlantis disappeared, which is around 9500 BC, which, by the way, I think he got absolutely bang on the nail as far as the end of this tumultuous period of cataclysm. You know, so we know that civilization goes back to at least 8000 9000 BC, and we've not even mentioned yet Göbekli Tepe in southeast Turkey, somewhere which I've written extensively about in my books, even a book which came out in 2014 called Göbekli Tepe, Genesis of the Gods, which I show to be one of the cradles of civilization in the ancient world, not just for the Sumerians and the Babylonians, but also for whole Bible stories and for the peoples of Palestine and Israel and whatever. Göbekli Tepe was another one of these points of foundation. And here you've got, right at the end of the Younger Dryas period, the end of the last ice age, these incredible complexes of megalithic structures like Stonehenge, but built several thousand years earlier, with these beautiful carvings of animals and humans and, you know, these alignments towards the stars. This is at 9500 BC. So, you know, this is the evidence of this lost civilization. But the important thing is to try and understand its point of origin. And I don't necessarily think that, as Donnelly suggested, that it is Atlantis. Atlantis was something that Plato tried to make out to be the beginning and the foundation of everything. But I just think it's a part, not a small part, but a part of a much bigger picture that's now emerging of the world's lost civilization.
Do you think it had alien source?
I don't think we need to involve aliens. I mean, I don't discount the possibility of some kind of non-terrestrial influence on human evolution. I mean, we certainly know that cosmic rays affect human evolution and mutations. So why not, through some kind of quantum entanglement, a connection with, as you might call them, aliens, and that they may have had some kind of impact on our understanding of technology and of mathematics and geometry, that's the word I'm looking for, geodesy, you know, earth grids, things like this. But I think that it's probably something much more subtler than simply nuts and bolts spacecraft coming down, men getting out, giving us, you know, the ancient wisdom, and then disappearing back to their home planet. I don't think that it's as easy as that. I think that there is a far more complex process of evolution, one that involves everything from the seeding from a much earlier type of human, like the Denisovans and the Neanderthals, through to cosmic rays, through to geology and geomagnetic effects upon our mind, and all of these things come to bear. Even diets affect, you know, evolution, come to bear on the flowering of civilization around the world.
Andrew, you are a fascinating guy, and we have just about run out of time. Could you tell you? I know you've mentioned a few times during the show a few of your books. How can people find out more of this about you and what you're doing?
Well, I mean, firstly, the website, www.andrewcollins.com. There is hundreds of articles on there on all of these subjects, from Göbekli Tepe to Atlantis, to the origins of civilizations, even this Denisovan legacy. It's all up there, all on the news page, all linked. Plus, even just overnight, I've added a brand new article, which was finished about 5 o'clock this morning, on Göbekli Tepe's most important T-shaped standing stone, Pillar 43, the so-called Vulture Stone, showing that it reflects this journey of the soul into the sky world, and it's been in the news recently. Read all about that. It's there for people now, and all my books are available through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or any good online store, or hopefully in any of your local bookshops. And I look forward to hearing from people if they've got any queries on any of these subjects.
Andrew Collins, thank you so much for being with us today, Andrew. You're a fascinating guy.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Obtaining wisdom is a long process, as no one can bestow it on us. The more we talk and hear each other's ideas, the more we'll be able to mature our own views. Questions and answers from the chat room for today's show and other shows will be posted on my website at davidgagan.com. You can ask other questions directly by going to the contact section of my website, and I'll publish those answers as well. Also, I cover these subjects and many more in my book, The Endless Journey. I look forward to sharing our thoughts every Friday morning at 9 a.m. United States Eastern Time here on W4CY.com. You can also find all the old episodes of both the Common Sense Spirituality Show and Aspects of Spirituality on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction, and it turns out to be an amazingly good news story. We all have a great destiny ahead of us. Let me leave you with one last thought. You are a unique spirit having a life experience. You are far more important in the grander scheme of things than you can possibly realize. Enjoy your life. You've earned it.